This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm Mark Riley.
And I'm Rob Hughes.
And you're listening to the A to Z of David Bowie,
the greatest rock and roll star in the world,
ever,
ever.
So, where are we going this time, Bob?
D is for Diamond Dogs. One of my favourites.
Just such a great, great record. Yeah. So recorded January, February 1974 at Olympic Studios and Island Studios in London and Ludolf Studios in the Netherlands.
Yeah, so it's Bowie's 8th studio album, this, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And a really interesting beast as well because of the backstory to it. But the first clue that a musical was on the way came in 1973 when he told a journalist that his next album would be a musical in one act called Tragic Moments.
That's a terrible title.
Yeah, it never came to fruition. Anyway, did it, and he'd also told others it would be called Revenge and the best haircut I'd ever had.
I love this.
So, I mean, he's obviously being playful as well, but do you know what is really, really kind of prescient for all of this? He's always talking about musicals, isn't he, Bowie?
Yeah.
You know, from early on he wanted to do musicals and he was interested in Lionel Bart. And let's not forget, what was his last act? Lazarus.
Of course.
So it's always been on his mind. Yeah. It's almost like that was the aim, the main goal that he wanted to get towards.
And you wonder, don't you? In the 60s, he's going through all these frustrations, as you say, inspired by Lionel Bart, Anthony Newley, that kind of thing. So he had this idea, probably unformed in his head, but he needed to do it at some point in his life.
He did, yeah. And he said the album would feature protest songs about how bad the food is in Harrods these days. So he's just being, like, playful and not taking anything too seriously. But the album was fraught with hurdles, we'll get to
it
that.
Was.
October 1973, he records 1984 and the Dodo segue, which he performed at the 1980 Floor show. And Dodo, such a great song, and just got left by the wayside really for a while, but that was the last recording session that he did with Ken Scott, who then went off to work with Supertramp on Crime of the Century.
I
saw that tour and I thought that was a great record. They're much derided, Supertramp. Everybody hates them.
I don't know that record. I know it's a huge one.
Well, Dreamer, you will know the song.
Of course I know Dreamer.
Right, okay, yeah. Well, that's on it, and Bloody Well Right, and I saw him at the Free Trade Hall and I thought it was a great record. But you know, jumping ship from Bowie to that, they sold millions, didn't they? So it worked for Ken Scott, I suppose.
Definitely. Okay, so over the next few months, Bowie spends some time working on the Astronettes LP with Ava Cherry and Jeff McCormack, a.k.a. War and Peace. By November 74, he'd met up with William Burroughs, hadn't he? And they discussed, amongst other things, the cut-up technique, which we discussed in C. Yep. And he was going to use this, certainly, more than he'd done before, on the next album, which, of course, became Diamond Dogs.
It was shortly after he'd met Burroughs that Bowie claimed to have written 20 new songs for what he called his kitchen sink record, 1984. Mm. Now, famously, this is a real stumbling block, the hurdle I was talking about. George Orwell's widow, Sonia, she just bluntly refused permission to rework George Orwell's novel. She just absolutely wasn't having it. So that went out the window, much to his annoyance and chagrin. And he described Sonia Orwell as the biggest upper-class snob I've ever met in my life.
Ooh.
Though apparently, allegedly, supposedly, he never actually got to meet her. Representatives were sent to meet her and came back with the stories. And then Bowie, he just gilded it a little bit with the fact that he thought that she was horrible, but he hadn't met her.
No, okay. Nevertheless, he wasn't put off by any of that. He used 1984 as a template for Hunger City, which was the central sort of location motif of Diamond Dogs, wasn't it? Which is Bowie's own vision of this post-apocalyptic future dystopian society, echoing the themes in Orwell's novel.
I mean, the thing is that he was obviously so mad that he just thought, right, I'm going to get around this. Mm. It can't be 1984. Fine. It's good, like, you know, the 1980 Floor show and having a song called 1984. You can't copyright a year. So he was obviously so mad. But he was also in a little bit of a pickle because obviously at this point in time, he'd gotten rid of the Spiders.
Mm.
And, you know, I mean, he relied so much for arrangements, as is well documented, particularly on Mick Ronson.
Yeah, sure.
So he was there recording this album and he didn't have his mates with him.
No, he didn't. So he decided at one point, he said, look, you know, I'm going to play everything myself, which you wouldn't put it past him, and you certainly had a go. And then, of course, he was practicing guitar, supposedly a couple of hours a day. But, of course, eventually he makes some phone calls, gets his black book out, makes some phone calls. He gets Mike Garson in on piano. You wouldn't want anybody else by your side, would you?
Absolutely.
Mike Garson, Ainsley Dunbar on drums, Tony Newman also on drums, Herbie Flowers, who'd played on Space Oddity to begin with, on bass, and Alan Parker, much underrated, on guitar.
Yeah, do you know, I call him the greatest living Englishman, but Vic Goddard of Subway Sect. He got to the point where he recognised Bowie's car and Bowie's driver.
Right.
And he was walking past a studio one day. It's obviously one of the studios we just mentioned, not sure which one. Mm. And he saw Bowie's car outside with the chauffeur. So he went up to him and he said, excuse me, is David in there? No, not at all. He said, well, he is actually, isn't he? No, he's not, no. So he just waited. And around about 4 o'clock that day, David Bowie came out.
Wow.
And Vic met him and got his autograph and all that. And he said, what have you been doing in there? He said, well, do you want to keep your eye out for a track called Rebel Rebel? He said, I've just been working on it now. I've been doing the drums all day. So, I mean, he was doing drums on Rebel Rebel, whether that made it to the final mix or not.
Yeah.
But a great little story.
Oh, wonderful.
So he started in December 1973. Keith Harwood was working on the album, who'd worked with the Stones and Led Zeppelin, loads of legendary bands, and also Tony Visconti brought
him. That's right, yeah. A phone call was made to former Spider Trevor Boulder around this time, wasn't it, who'd worked on what described as a nothing song that never really got recorded, and they never worked together again. Boulder had said that David wouldn't even say goodbye to him on the day.
He just sat there and he was a little bit uncomfortable, and then he was like, yeah, okay, see ya, and then, see ya, bye Dave, I'm off now, and nothing at all. I mean, who knows what that was about, but yeah, they were never to work again. Of course, he went off to Wishbone Ash for a short while with Trevor Boulder, and obviously to Uriah Heep for an awful long time. And I don't like Uriah Heep. I bought the first album because somebody recommended it, and it's crackers.
Mm.
And the music's good, largely.
Yeah.
The lyrics are ridiculous. But he was in them for an awful long time.
Was.
But I went to see Uriah Heep just to watch Trevor Boulder playing bass. Such a great fella he seems, you know. He's the only Spider I never got to meet.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Oh, so rumour has it also around this time, we know, we've kind of discussed this in C, that Bowie was starting to become a regular cocaine user, so it's part of his life, and it certainly feeds into Diamond Dogs, doesn't it, the creation of it.
It does, yeah. And also, at this point in time, maybe the two things are related, but the main man relationship, it was getting a little bit frosty, wasn't it? You know, so they'd not been paying the studio fees, apparently, or the office fees, and so the pressure was on Bowie to come up with a record. Again, you look at various stages of Bowie's career, and you're thinking, like, when he's in Berlin, he was Skint. At this point in time, they're saying, come on, we need another record, Davey. Come on, off the back of Pin-Ups, which was massive, obviously, cover versions.
Yeah.
You know? But then you've also Aladdin Sane, Ziggy Stardust, all of the previous albums. When Ziggy got big, the other albums started selling as well. So there must have been loads of money coming through and obviously loads of money going out.
As I say, Bowie wasn't really seeing any of it, was he?
No.
When it came to the creative side of things, obviously been through Ziggy, Aladdin Sane, so he needed a new character. So this is the way he introduces Halloween Jack, who is a figure in Diamond Dogs.
That's right, and it's been described as Bowie's darkest album since The Man Who Sold the World, you know, and there were drug references in there. I mean, there were drug references in previous Bowie things, but this kind of seemed to be more kind of first-hand rather than documenting other people's lives, you know, like Billy Dolls and all that kind of
Definitely.
Stuff.
Mike Garson described the album as macabre, didn't he? And he was concerned for Bowie's health, so he starts to lose weight at this point, not looking great, a result of overwork, drug use, probably a lot of pressure, as you say, from main man as well, so he's feeling it at this time.
And I mean, obviously, the Ziggy tour took it out of him. The point that the Ziggy tour finished, they were actually supposed to be going to certainly America, I think it might have been Japan as well, but Bowie was exhausted and just didn't know what was going on with the money, and it was a very fractious time in his life. And again, Pin-Ups was a holding operation.
Yeah, it was.
It's a great one. It's by no means Bowie's best album, is it? You know, a load of cover versions, as I say, but bringing the money in, and
certainly,
it's just a weird thing. But anyway, it's always a Bowie album that is my number one album, but it does change. And quite often it is Young Americans. It could be Hunky Dory. It could be Station to Station. It could be, at times, Diamond Dogs. I love it.
It's the same thing with me. Usually it's Hunky Dory or Low, but I've got a real soft spot for Diamond Dogs for many, many reasons. One of them being the opening track, Future Legend, which I I'm guessing the same with you. I used to know off by heart. And it still goes through my head every now and then. And I stumble a few times. But it's right there. It's just a great intro. It sets up the whole thing.
It really, really does. And it's so William Burroughs in itself, isn't it? 1 minute long. It just sets up the agenda and the plot for the rest of the album. And within it, they use that beautiful section of music, don't they? Richard Rodgers, Bewitched, Bothered and Bewildered.
Yeah.
Which is just that beautiful melody on the guitar. Yeah. Really great. And that was also used apparently as an intro of some of the North American tour as well. Track two, Diamond Dogs.
All right, so this is a single, of course, as well. Starts off with a great line, "This ain't rock and roll, this is genocide," followed by the crowd noise, which was supposedly lifted from a Faces gig.
Yeah, apparently you can hear Rod Stewart within it. So that's the thing. But, and again, it's a great record. And at the time, I didn't see it because I wasn't an aficionado and I'm still not of the Rolling Stones. We all know their oeuvre.
Yeah.
God, that's a big word for me. But if you listen to it now, it is very Stonesy, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it.
There is a story that Bowie came up with this riff just to piss off Mick Jagger a little bit.
Really?
Definitely. He didn't even hide the influence there. It's certainly Stonesy.
Well, he'd already upset, to paraphrase, Mick Jagger, because there's that great story, isn't it? The cover of Diamond Dogs by Guy Pillar. And he'd already done some work for the Stones, but it hadn't come out yet.
That's It's Only Rock and Roll, wasn't it?
It's Only Rock and Roll. And so Jagger showed it to Bowie and thought, aye, I like this. And he showed him Rock Dreams, I think, as well. I think that's the way the story goes, in that order. And so Bowie went off and got hold of Guy Pillar and got him to do the cover. We'll discuss that in a short while, maybe, the cover. But Mick Jagger was really, really upset about this, and apparently he said, never show David Bowie your new shoes.
Is that right?
Yeah, because he'll just go out immediately and buy the exact same pair and wear them out before you do.
Right, be warned. We next come to, this is probably, when I think about it, this is probably my favourite Bowie track, and it is a sweet, Sweet Thing Candidate, Sweet Thing Reprise.
It's just remarkable, and quite possibly Bowie's greatest vocal performance. It's certainly up there, isn't it?
I was going to get to this. When Bowie died, I thought it was very noticeable that a lot of people were talking about how influential he was, what a great musician he was, songwriter, and very few people mentioned what an amazing singer he was, a great vocalist.
Yeah.
They'd lost sight of this, and I think Diamond Dogs, one of the reasons this is one of my favourite Bowie albums, sometimes my favourite, is because this is where he really comes into his own. Talking about musicals, it's almost like he's reaching for the musical in a lot of places here.
Well, it certainly is, you know, and it was so theatrical, the tour that went out across North America that we have discussed and probably will load more as well. But that was kind of a pivotal point from the look of it, with Bowie on the scaffolding. Again, you got to see it on Cracked Action, with him with the big coat on and leaning against the skyscraper and all that kind of stuff. It's one of those that just sets the hairs on the back of your head.
Oh, yeah.
I remember Jarvis Cocker played Just Sweet Thing on Six Music one afternoon. One Sunday afternoon, and I sent him a text. I said, Jarv, you cannot do this. Yeah. Quite simply, you are not allowed to play Just Sweet Thing without Candidate, Sweet Thing Reprise.
No.
It's not allowed, mate. I'll let you off this time. And he played it again some months further down the line, told that little story, and played the full kit and caboodle. And he acknowledged the fact that, yeah, it is wrong. It's like chopping a limb off and just showing it to somebody. It's just ridiculous.
I mean, there is a bit particularly in Sweet Thing Reprise where Bowie sings It's All I Ever Wanted, and it always gives me goosebumps. That is incredible.
Yeah, it is so great. And part of Sweet Thing Reprise was also, it had featured in bootlegs previously, had been called Zion and Aladdin Vane and all that, but it's just kind of some of the little passages that lead into various sections of that song, but it had been dabbled with before, apparently, allegedly, supposedly, even possibly recorded in the Aladdin Sane and Pinup sessions. So, you know, and there are bootlegs that I've heard of that section of music.
Okay, Rebel Rebel, which we mentioned before in the Vic Goddard thing, originally written for an aborted Ziggy musical in late 73, so it's all coming round to musicals all the time. Considered to be Bowie's last glam rock track, and I do have a memory of this being used on a TV advert in the mid-70s, which is where I first heard Rebel Rebel.
Right.
It was either for jeans or perfume. I'm pretty sure it's perfume. There's very little record of it now if you go online.
Sure.
But it was there, definitely.
Right, okay. And it's a really great American version of this, isn't it? With lots of backing vocals and all that, which, again, I heard like years later and absolutely loved it. His first hit not to feature Mick Ronson since 1969.
Ooh.
So that's a pivotal point, really. And Bowie just said, it's a fabulous riff, just fabulous. When I stumbled on it, it was, oh, thank you.
Okay.
That wasn't an impersonation of Bowie, by the way.
No. There is a great story, isn't there, that Bowie tells. He was in a hotel one night in London, in later years, and he could hear somebody upstairs playing a guitar really, really badly, and it was the Rebel Rebel riff over and over, but as I say, stumbling over it, really awful. And he couldn't stand it, because Bowie had to be up very early the next morning for a TV appearance or whatever. So he went up there, knocked on the door, and told him to shut up. and it was John McEnroe, wasn't it?
It was. And the irony being, I mean, he should have just really been playing the tennis racket, bit of air guitar, shouldn't
exactly.
he? But he was making a right dog's dinner of it, wasn't
yeah.
he? Imagine that, Bowie knocking on your door and then coming in and showing you how to play. But it is one of the great riffs. It's not even that hard to play, but it's just a great, great rock and roll. And again, very, very Stonesy.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, wonderful okay. piece of work. Okay, so when Jeff McCormack came on the first anniversary of Bowie's death on your radio show, he talked about the next song we're going to talk about, which is Rock and Roll With Me, which is a lovely tune. It's a co-write with Bowie, wasn't it, this?
Yeah, I mean, he said he was round Bowie's apartment and he just started, Jeff just started playing on the piano and Bowie's ear pricked up and said, oh yeah, what's that? Like that? And so they sat down and wrote a song together. And it's a beautiful song. Jeff did tell me that it was credited to Bowie and Warren Peace, which was his non-deprim.
Yeah, sure.
And as a result, he didn't get any royalties. That's what he said to me.
Okay.
And he said that it was kind of like a bit of smoke and mirrors, but as if Warren Peace was a Bowie character. You know, a little bit like Halloween Jack or Ziggy Stardust or whatever, and he didn't actually exist because, well, he didn't. It was a non-deplume, but
yeah.
it was a non-deplume not for a David Bowie again, but for Jeff McCormack.
And so
he didn't get the monies that he deserved, which is very, very wrong. I mean, I'm sure he got sorted out in other ways because Bowie was like, you know, they were just inseparable right to the end. And we'll be talking about Jeff an awful lot in different episodes.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely.
It is a great soul song. And as Bowie was tended to do on all his albums, there'd always be a pointer to where the next album was going to go, and this is the one that points to young Americans, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty soulful, isn't it? And also, track 8, We Are the Dead. I adore this one as well. But undervalued, I think, really sinister and brooding, and yeah, not much more I can say about that, really.
1984, which we've mentioned already. So this is Sonia Orwell, Couldn't Stop Bowie Using 1984, as you've said, yeah, we've no copyright on that, which is the centrepiece for the musical It Never Quite Was, and it definitely borrows, naturally, from Theme from Shaft by Isaac Hayes.
It does, yeah, and clearly uses Bowie's version of Winston Smith's Misfortunes in 1984. So again, it's a little bit like no. He's going to skirt as close as he can to 1984 without actually overstepping the line and upsetting Sonia. You wouldn't want to do that, would you?
No, you wouldn't. And we should also mention this is a great guitar masterpiece by Alan Parker, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, fantastic. Track 10, Big Brother.
Oh, I love this. This is another great vocal performance by Bowie. It's really terrific. Stays close to the novel, as you'd imagine by the title, Big Brother, which then seegs into Chant of the Ever-Circling Skeletal Family, which is just a piece of madness. It's a brilliant end to the record, isn't it? But it just works so beautifully.
It is. And so we've covered all the tracks. Let's get back briefly to the album cover itself. So, Rock Dreams, and as we've mentioned before, Jagger, and It's Only Rock and Roll. So Bowie does it, and there are shots. Are they by Terry O'Neill, the initial shot? So you've got Bowie lying down in that same position as the dog, and that was used as a template for Guy Pillart to work from. And so famously there was a big furore, wasn't there, about the fact that the dog actually had some testicles hanging
genitalia
down.
Yes.
Genitalia,
yeah.
Thank you, Bob. You will be aware of this. But when the album was being don't look at me like that.
It's just I said genitalia.
Don't worry, it's alright. When they were actually just saying that this album is looming large and they were doing all the displays in the record shops, they've sent out loads and loads of covers for Diamond Dogs before the record had been pressed and approved and all that kind of stuff. And so they would make up these displays and get like 20 record covers, staple them to the wall, put a poster up, David Bowie, Diamond Dogs, out such and such a date. And then it transpires that all of those covers were actually with the genitalia, which by the time the album was released, had got taken off because it was objected to.
Yeah, it'd been airbrushed out.
So, I mean, I am going back 10 years now, and those covers were going for thousands, absolutely thousands. So if you've got one, it might have a couple of staple holes in it, but it will have a couple of something else on it as well.
Absolutely worth having, well, for the artwork, clearly. I mean, when you think they were plastered over all shop fronts all over the States, they are knocking about. I'd love to know if people have them, if save them.
Yeah, I know somebody who's got one, and it's a treasured possession and a pension as well. But also, talking of advertising, particularly Diamond Dogs, I do remember going into a shop in Northenden, quite near where I still live, actually, and there was a little yellow sticker on the door. Just remember it vividly, said, order Davey Bowie's new single, Rebel Rebel. So I was like, whoa. Went up to the counter, this frosty old lady there, and I said, excuse me, could I order the Davey Bowie single, Rebel Rebel, please? And she went, what do you want to do that for? I said, well, there's a sticker on the window saying order it here. Yeah, so why do you want to order it? Because it says on there I need to order, you know, and so she wouldn't let me order it. She said, just come and buy it. So I did, I went and bought it. But to this day, I still wish I'd just nicked that sticker off the window because she didn't need it.
No, of course she didn't.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah. What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Didn't.
The A to Z of David Bowie with Rob Hughes and Mark Riley.
D is for Tony DeFries.
Born 3rd of September 1943 in Rickmansworth in Hertfordshire, a sickly child by all accounts, he suffered from asthma, which led to spells in hospital. He then followed his brother into the legal profession, and for 10 years he was a litigation clerk, which came in very handy for management.
Yeah, it might also come in very handy if he wants to take me and you to court, Bob. So we need to tread very carefully here. He worked with showbiz lawyer Lawrence Myers, who worked for Mickey Most, the impresario, and loads of other people, obviously. And he also helped out in a legal wrangle involving the Geordie band, the Animals, whatever that might have been.
Okay, and he had dealings with Alan Klein, who later gained a notorious reputation for his work with the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. It's suggested he learned quite a bit from Alan Klein.
Well, I mean, Alan Klein, notorious. We talked about the managers. You know, there was Don Arden and Peter Grant, who played Hardball, didn't they? You know, and Don Arden being Sharon Arden's dad, who's Sharon Osbourne. Yeah. So there's a line running through here of a certain type of management. We've talked about it before. So you'd have the kind of old Tin Pan Alley guys, really kind of sweet and just knocking around in show business and not really ruthless. And you've got the almost pretty gnarly characters who could see money to be made.
Yeah.
And we're getting in there. I'm not suggesting Tony DeFries either.
No.
By the way.
Well done, Mark. Very nice indeed. As he sidestepped. So by 1968, DeFries is working as a clerk at Godfrey Davis and Batt. And he has over 2 years of experience, which then sets him up. By the early 70s, Angie Bowie actually encouraged David Bowie to talk to Philips Records general manager, who was called Olaf Wiper, I kid you not.
This is his name.
About being dissatisfied with Ken Pitt as manager and thinking, who else could we have instead?
And so, yeah, Angie's steering leads him to Tony DeFries. So it's the 7th of May, 1970, and this is quite brutal as well, but, I suppose every now and then you just have to be. Tony DeFries calls a meeting with Ken Pitt, Bowie's manager at the time, and David Bowie. And Ken Pitt, he reluctantly agreed to rip up the contract with Bowie for just £2,000. Now, he did this, but he never actually got paid. And I would wager, you know, he never got over it, because Bowie lived in the flat with Ken Pitt for a long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he really looked after him. When I went to the V&A exhibition, the first time I went was for a private showing, and there were only about eight of us in there. It was a real honour, and we just spent loads of time in there. There was nobody else in queues behind us. We just did what we wanted for a couple of hours. And in amongst the eight people, there was George Underwood was there, and Hermione, but also Ken Pitt.
Ah, well.
He just looked like a very sweet old guy and really not the gnarly hoodlum that we were talking about before.
I mean, there is a story about years later that Ken Pitt did receive some compensation for his sort of dealings later on. It was only about £15,000 from what I've read anyway. So
Justice was done in the end, wasn't it? Yeah. Then, as if that wasn't enough, Tony DeFries called for an audit of Ken Pitt's accounts. Right now, this is, again, very, very prescient, really. So they don't find out that Ken Pitt has been ripping off David Bowie. They find out that Ken Pitt has been undercharging him and not charging him enough commission and all that kind of stuff. So a sweet man, a very, very sweet man.
OK, so with Bowie on the books, DeFries starts about freeing the artist from his existing contract with Mercury. So he pays them £20,000 to free up two albums that Bowie recorded for them, Man Who Sold the World and Hunky Dory.
Again, a brilliant move because, I mean, he was so confident that Bowie was going to crack
yes.
it. And he was so confident that nobody had bought those albums, Hunky Dory not being out. But, you know, at that point in time, Man Who Sold the World, nobody bought it. As we know, we talk about collectible records. You know, the original dress sleeve, that goes for about £1,500 now, quite simply because nobody bought it at the time.
That's right.
And so that was a brilliant move. So when he went over to the next company, which would be RCA, he already had a bit of back catalogue to plunder as well.
Yeah.
So it's September 1971, Bowie signs to RCA, and it's all DeFreeze's doing by the look of it. And it's also reputedly, because RCA was a home of Elvis Presley.
Yes, yeah.
And, David Bowie, who wouldn't be, a massive Elvis Presley fan. And Tony DeFreeze looked at it and thought, right, yeah, they've got the biggest rock star in the world. Well, David Bowie is going to be the next biggest rock star in the world. It's a good home for him.
Definitely. So here's where DeFreeze really comes into his own. This is a masterstroke, really. So he has the idea, look, we know you're not a star at the moment, but here it is. If you act like a star, people will treat you like one. Hence, this is where you get Bowie stays in the best hotels, gets limousines, gets bodyguards, still only on a very, very small wage, but to all intents and purposes from the outside, he is a star.
Yeah, I mean, that's why people were looking at him and thinking, God, he must be so successful because he's got this entourage and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I mean, the Spiders particularly really were like, you know, they were living the life of luxury. But there's a story, I think it's while they were staying in California, but they were getting everything they wanted, you know, on room service, they had accounts in the hotels, no bother. But they didn't have any cash at all. Right. So if they wanted a packet of cigarettes, they had to go out and apparently like offer somebody a bottle of champagne for a packet of cigs.
Is that right?
Yeah. And going back to the Elvis thing as well, I mean, you know, talking about Bowie being a fan, there's a really great story of Bowie going to see Elvis Presley at Madison Square Garden, turning up a little bit late and clomping down the aisle of Madison Square Garden whilst Elvis Presley is on stage in all of his finery, like, you know, some of his outlandish clobber and his platform boots, and Elvis Presley giving him the evil eye as he's going down. And you would, wouldn't you?
Of course you
You've
would.
You've got, like, the greatest rock and roll star in the world at that point in time on stage, and you've got this creature that most people wouldn't even recognise at that point in time. Everybody turning around and looking at him.
And having the temerity to turn up late. So Main Man, which is DeFreeze's management company, expands then. So not only do they have an office in London, they open one in New York with an apartment attached to it on the side.
That's where the money was going, obviously, you know.
Definitely. So Bowie's getting the star treatment and also the freedom. So at least he's given the artistic freedom. Let's do what you want. You deliver this and we'll be good to you. That's the idea. So Main Man starts to expand on the back of Bowie. So you got Mott the Hoople, Dana Gillespie, you got the Stooges, Lou Reed and George Underwood.
Yeah, George Underwood. At this point in time, he'd been in bands with George when he was much, much younger, and George being a childhood friend and everything. And he'd made some solo records as well, but he didn't have star quality, really. Yeah. No offence, George. And he did the great artwork for Bowie and Bolan. Mm. So we know all that. But he even managed to get his mate on the roster as well. So he enjoyed that, didn't he?
Definitely.
We know Bowie liked to kind of Svengali other people's careers, and sometimes more successful than others.
But, you know, there was definitely the star man, and then there were the people underneath. So you've got DeFreeze supposedly being less generous towards the band themselves. There is a story that, well, Woody Woodmanty tells the story, doesn't he, that DeFreeze has said, look, we'd rather pay the road crew more than we pay you.
That came after Woody Woodmanty was sat next to Mike Garson on a plane, and Woody was looking in a magazine, and there was a Porsche on there, or, you know, within the magazine, he's looking at it going, oh, and he said to Mike Garson, I'd love one of them. So Mike Garson said, well, at the end of the tour, why don't you buy one? He went, you're joking, are you? How much money do you think I'm making? He went, I don't know. And he said, well, how much are you making? And it transpired that Mike Garson, the new boy, was getting 10 times what the Spiders were getting, or at least what Woody and Trevor were getting. And so he was severely hacked off, and that's what brought about the conversation going to DeFreeze and saying, what's happening here? You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's been so demoralising for the Spiders. I mean, it was really, essentially, that was the beginning of the end, wasn't it? Because they were assured at the start of the Aladdin Sane tour that, look, at the end of this, lads, it's fine, you can afford a house each, you'll be fine, you'll be in clover. And it never happened.
Yeah, I mean, and you have to imagine them being on the road with all this finery, getting used to the best treatment and just going wherever you wanted, doing whatever you wanted, all around the world. And, yeah, when you get back, yeah, sorry, lads, yeah, that's it.
Yeah. At the same time, you've got Bowie's contract, which has been, you know, various stories about this, but normally the management would take between 10 and 20%. That would be fair, wouldn't it?
Yep. But
the story goes that DeFreeze took 50%.
Which, I mean, if that is right, it's got to be one of the worst deals to sign in the history of music, really. Just ridiculous.
Yeah. So they split by 75, but I mean, the contract that Bowie had signed with De Vries went on. I mean, the repercussions went on for quite a number of years.
They did. Lots of wrangling. I mean, Bowie severed ties with him eventually, but it cost him a lot of money. It was a real blow, but he just felt he had to cut ties with him. And I think it has been mentioned, and it will be mentioned, the fact that Bowie didn't pay as much as he might have done to some of the musicians along the way. That has been documented.
So it's interesting, De Vries is, you know, the way he's viewed by Bowie files now, some people see him as opportunistic, but other people say, well, you know, he's an enabler. He was able to get Bowie to where he wanted to be, at least.
Yeah.
Okay, and it's worth perhaps saying here what happened to Tony De Vries. So just a bit of research on this. So he's no longer in the music business. Apparently, he runs a company now out of Los Angeles, a research company, and he's currently working on a flexible electronic quantum battery powered entirely by light and human biophotons. He describes himself as a self-directed quantum physicist and material scientist.
I bet he does.
The A to Z of David Bowie, with Mark Riley and Rob Hughes.
D is also for Derek and Clive.
Oh dear. So, Dudley Moore, Derek, Peter Cook, Clive. So, in essence, it's a filthy, obscene, shocking and pretty hilarious, in parts, extension of the Pete and Dud characters that they brought through in the 60s, was very popular, and David Bowie, we know, was a huge fan.
Absolutely. At this point, though, Peter Cook's alcoholism had become a really big problem and he and Dud weren't getting on at all.
Yeah, so they were in New York, weren't they? And they were doing the review show, Good Evening, which was based on the TV show Not Only But Also, which was huge. Mm. And, this is where it gets a little bit odd. Peter Cook tried to diffuse the tension, albeit the tension he was causing, by the look of it, by hiring a recording studio in New York, where under no pressure or spotlight, they could drink and just riff off each other, just making it all up as he went along, but under the guise of just for fun.
Yes, that's the thing. But the just for fun is a strange one, isn't it? This is a double-edged sword, really. So you've got two guys just obviously adored each other back in the 60s, a different relationship in the 70s, and there's so much needle in there, isn't there? Some wonderful bits, great flights of fancy, brilliant comedy and the rest of it. At the same time, there's some quite kind of ugly stuff.
It's almost bullying in parts, isn't it? I mean, obviously Peter Cook was quite caustic and Dud wasn't. With the characters, but those characters just seemed to grow within them, didn't they, you know? And so the tapes got out. It's a little bit like the Bob Dylan tapes, the basement tapes, isn't it? So, you know, they weren't meant to get out, but every musician had the basement tapes. And so, and it was the same with the Trogs tapes as well. If you don't know what the Trogs tapes are, then search them out. Hilarious. But they weren't meant for public consumption. And neither were these, supposedly. But people ended up with them. And Peter Cook, he now actually wasn't making as much money as Dudley Moore and thought, well, if everybody likes it, we may as well stick it out. Now, bear in mind, it's filthy and toe-curling in parts.
Yes.
And so Dudley Moore, being famous at this point in time, he's a Hollywood star, he wasn't quite so keen.
No, he wasn't. But they put it out anyway. So you've got Derek and Clive live. Two more albums released fairly quickly after Derek and Clive Come Again and Ad Nauseam, which is the famous sleeve, isn't it, with basically some vomit in a plastic bag on
the
cover.
Pretty gruesome, yeah. The last two records particularly were just a growing ensemble of two people getting at each other, and more often than not, just poor old Dud getting bruised and bruised and bruised. There's one particular sketch called Cancer, which, you know, regardless of what you've been through in your life or what you know your family have been through or whatever, it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But Peter Cook knew full well that Dudley Moore's dad had just passed away from cancer and decided to riff off it and just to goad him and upset him, which, say uncomfortable listen, doesn't even cover it.
No, I was going to say, it's such a difficult listen at times, isn't it? And you do wonder along the way whether people, obviously we're hearing this, people at the record company and the rest, did nobody kind of say, maybe we should just water this down and maybe kind of edit bits out? But it never seemed to happen. It seemed to just go straight from the studio to the record undiluted.
Yeah, and so Bowie was a huge fan of Pete and Dud and Derek and Clive as well. And there's a great photo, isn't there, from 1973 of the three of them. Didn't you say that Peter Cook had run a caption underneath the picture of the three of them?
Yeah, it's at the Cambridge Theatre in Covent Garden, May 73. And so you've got from left to right, you've got Peter Cook, you've got Bowie and then Dudley Moore. And Peter Cook captioned it later as Lord Gnome, Laughing Gnome and Garden Gnome.
Again, just having a pop at Dudley and his size and all that kind of stuff, you know. But the weird thing is, Brian Eno said this and... he doesn't even bear thinking about, really, but he did say that we never, ever spoke to each other in anything other than Derek and Clive voices. Now, that can't be true.
It can't be true, but it's a great image. And he has said that several times, Brian Eno, hasn't he?
Yeah.
He asserts that's the only form of communication in the studio.
I'm sure they did it a lot, but, I mean, yeah, I can't imagine him going to a bar and just being Derek and Clive. Maybe they did. Maybe they, he should know, shouldn't he? July 1971, Bowie asked DeFries to write to Dudley Moore, asking him to play piano on what was to become Hunky Dory.
Wow.
This is incredible. And, you know, and Life on Mars, he could obviously at that point in time hearing it in his mind, this big piece with a great pianist on it, and he wanted Dudley Moore, but Dudley Moore never got back to him, did
what
he?
What a great projected scenario that was. Instead of Rick Wakeman, it could have been Dudley Moore.
Yeah, I'd like to see Dudley Moore in a cape with long blonde hair.
Me too, sure. So Moore and Peter Cook were guests on Ziggy's Last Stand. This is the Hammersmith Odeon show in July 1973. So they're at the Café Royal. Bowie had this huge big party afterwards. Anybody who was anybody was there. The Jaggers, Ringo, Paul and Linda McCartney, Keith Moon, Lou Reed, Jeff Beck, Barbara Streisand, Spike Milligan.
Spike Milligan. So I would pay to see Spike Milligan, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore in the same room anyway. Amazing, yeah? And you know what? I mean, I'll just throw this in, but the last time that I met David, we did an interview in a hotel in London, and it was just around about a week before he actually performed for the very last time. Mm. And that was the last interview that he did for 10 years, I think. I think he might have done one more interview after that with Courtney Pine, is what I'm led to believe. So it very nearly was the last interview for radio that David ever did. But before we even started the interview, luckily the engineer who came with us to record it had set it off, and I'd not had a chance to set it up right. I'm here in a, you know, a hotel room with David Bowie. We've got some gigs coming up, this, that and the other. He just went off and he just said that there was a knock on the door, and so immediately he invites me in. So I'm going, oh yeah, who was it? Well, it's John and Paul, isn't it? Is it? Yeah, it is, yeah. And it goes on like this, and he's already set up,
yeah.
And it is very Pete and Dud. If you can listen to it, you will hear it. And he goes off riffing with me just going, all right, oh, you what? You're joking. All that kind of stuff. And he tells a story, which I'm presuming it might be partly based in truth. I'm not sure. You never knew with David Bowie.
Yeah.
But that there was a knock on the door, and it was John Lennon and Paul McCartney, and they came in, and they discussed forming a supergroup, which Bowie said they wanted to call David Bowie and the Beatles. So maybe... make of that what you will. And he said, we worked it all out. He said, it was really great. It was going well. We had a great night together. And then what do you think happened the next day? And I said, what happened? Nothing. Typical Scousers.
It is a great interview because it just shows the whole mischievous side of Bowie, because there's no point during that interview, as far as I can remember, where he just stays on track. He doesn't want to talk about anything normal. He's just off.
He's not interested. He starts talking about them finding seahorses in the Thames for the first time in 20 years and all this. And when I try and get him back talking about the album and the tour, not having it, he just wants to get into this comedic persona and just fly with it. And it's a great listen. But you could hear aspects of Pete and Dud in there, most certainly.
The A to Z of David Bowie was written and presented by Rob Hughes and Mark Riley, and recorded and edited by Howard Knock. If you'd like to review or rate this podcast, well, that would be much appreciated. In the next episode...
David Live.
Bob Dylan.
Dennis Davis.
Donna Gillespie.
Dick Cavett.
Decca.
Jeff Dexter.
D-Ram.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.